are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of compassion, spirituality, and well-being. Come and you shall know peace and joy. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship, and especially warm welcome to those worshipping with us for the first time. Your presence enriches us. My name's Jenny Dyster and I'm the recently appointed lay leader of this congregation. Generations of seekers of truth and meaning from all over the world have worshipped as this fellowship since 1854. The roots of this place go deeper, for this land we meet on is the land of the Kaurna people. We respect and bless their spiritual relationship with their country and their elders, past and present. Our Unitarian Church is a spiritual community, one that supports you in seeking and following your spiritual path. We don't prescribe theology or direct you on a spiritual journey. Your path is yours to find, and the role of the church is to support you on that path. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world. Please do join us after the service for coffee, tea, and conversation. My next candle will be for John Shelby Spong, who died last Sunday. We didn't have the news, of course, last Sunday because of the time difference. The obituaries came out this week. The last candle I lit was for those joys and concerns that are important to us but remain silent in our hearts. We now come to that time in the service where we go within. Kierkegaard said the purpose of prayer is not to influence God, but gently and gradually to transform ourselves. The purpose of meditation is the same. So take a moment and, sitting comfortably, draw your attention within. Close your eyes if you wish and be still. Be comfortable. Be calm. Be wholly within your own being. I will sound a bell at the end of the meditation and I will begin with a short prayer. Love is born with a dark and troubled face when hope is dead, and in the most unlikely place, love is born. Love is always born. It was a bit of a contrast with the first song, wasn't it? Then I saw her face, now I'm a believer, not a trace of doubt of my mind, now I'm a believer. Love has to be the biggest theme ever for songs, poetry, drama, operas, but its durability, shall we say, is dubious. The lyrics of I'm a Believer set you up to know things often go wrong. You put in more than you get. You want sunshine, you get rain. But just seeing her face turns the singer into a believer, devoted, committed, no doubts, and also no inkling what's in her mind. Last weekend, a dozen of us, this is on Father's Day, trooped off to see The Hypochondriac, which was an updated version of Molière's classic farce. The Hypochondriac is a rich man whose money disappears into the coffers of doctors, in whom he believes implicitly, and his wife, in whose love he believes without a shadow of a doubt. Well, she's actually thrilled to bits when he dies. Alas, he has no inkling into her true feelings. And alas for her, the death was fate, so her bad character is exposed, while the daughter exposes her true love for her father and in the end gets to marry her love instead of the congenital idiot of a doctor her father wanted her to marry. So love gets it gone, but belief doesn't. And the mistaken belief in love has been a source of comedy forever. How now, Malvolio?
Sweet lady, oh-ho!
Smilest thou? I sent for thee on a sad occasion.
Sad, lady? Why, it could be sad. This does make some obstruction in the blood, this cross-gartering, but what of that? If it please the eye of one, it's with me as the very true sonnet is. Please one, please all.
Why? How dost thou, man? What is the matter with thee?
Not black in my mind, yellow in my legs. It did come to his hands, and commands shall be executed. I think we know the sweet Roman hand.
Wilt thou go to bed, Malvolio?
Aye, to bed, my lady, with thee.
You can see this isn't going to end well. And you can see by the slide who set it up. It's the servant girl, Maria, who was absolutely sick of Malvolio's self-love, his puritanical dislike of revelry and fun, and his superiority. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Malvolio is cast into a lunatic asylum and released, stripped of all dignity, the only unfunny note in an otherwise hilarious Shakespearean comedy, written in 1601. So where do we go for an authentic version of love? Maybe Paul's letter to the Corinthians.
Three words: love, laughter, and respect. If I speak in human and angelic tongues, but do not have love, I am a resounding gong or a clashing cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and comprehend all mysteries and all knowledge, if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away everything I own, and if I hand my body over so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not jealous. It is not pompous. It is not inflated. It is not rude. It does not seek its own interests. It is not quick-tempered, does not brood over injury. It does not rejoice over wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails.
The beauty of those words ensures that they are included in almost all the church wedding services I've ever attended. It describes a love that cannot be surpassed. It's so authentic, so genuine, so unselfish. A loved one would be blessed indeed to receive love like this. It's a bit more alarming to think that that might be expected of you to give. It's setting the bar very high indeed. Now, the other commonly read quote from the Bible comes from the book of Ruth.
Ruth 1:16-18. Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, I will die, and there will I be buried.
Thanks, Janet. The point, though, is that this is not a prescription for married life in the Book of Ruth, which was a very short book. I showed you the whole thing. That's the four pages. That's it. The context of this quote is after the death of the husbands. Naomi's husband and her two sons die in the land of Moab. Naomi and her husband went there to live during a famine in Judah, and the lads married Moabite women. So after the men in their lives die, thrice bereaved Naomi, father and both sons, packs the women off back to their people and plans to return to Bethlehem. "You see," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth won't go. The words in the reading are addressed by Ruth to her mother-in-law. The book of Ruth is very short on detail, so we actually have no inkling of what inspired this extraordinary loyalty and devotion. But there you go. My point is, if you're a believer, what do you believe? If you ignore context and accept that quote, "Whither thou goest, I go," etc., as a high bar for wifely devotion, you are setting up monstrous expectations. Of course, a couple of generations ago, women were expected to trail around after their husbands. My paternal grandmother did, with fairly bad grace on occasions. My father recalls as a small child reporting to his mum that the plaster was falling off the walls of the boy's bedroom. He had two brothers. "Good," snapped Grandma. "I hope the whole damn place falls down." Now, as it happened, Grandpa concurred about the general state of the schoolhouse in Waitayakawi. It's in the middle of the mid-north on the barrier highway between Hallett and Tarawi, for those who don't know. When asked to fill in a public buildings department requisition for repairs and maintenance, Grandpa, under general comments, wrote, "Not fit for a pig to live in." As a result, he lost 3 promotion points, which took him some years to win back. He used to tell a story for laughs before advising younger colleagues to be tactful in their approach to school inspectors and so on. Now, my dad always conferred with postings with my mother. When offered the choice between Minipa and Dark Peak, Minipa having no power and Dark Peak having DC power only, Mum opted for the former, saying no way was she going to live in a place called Dark Peak. Well, it turns out the department had it wrong. Minipa was the place with the direct current power supply, and Dark Peak was the one with the Kero lamps and no mod cons. And of course, in my generation and beyond, you see husbands following their wives' careers if the wife's got a better job, and you see all sorts of negotiation happening. If you look at movies and musicals, old and new, you see many examples of what we would describe as abusive relationships or codependent relationships passed off as romantic love. Think of Carousel, musical in the 50s. Story revolves around rough-talking, macho, handsome Carousel Barker, Billy, and Julie, a young, innocent mill worker. They fall in love, but they're both fired for their jobs. He's fired by Mrs. Mullen because she's jealous of all the attention he gives to Julie, and Julie stays out on a date with him past the curfew imposed by the mill owner. Well, they have to relocate. They go and marry and live at a seaside spa. It doesn't go well. Billy gets frustrated and bitter and gives Julie a backhander. Mrs. Mullen hears about this and she's pretty pleased. She offers Billy his job back, as long as he leaves Julie. Julie asks to speak with him privately, and fearing he'll be enraged, she timidly tells him she's pregnant. Billy's overjoyed and he firmly refuses Mrs. Mullen's offer. However, newly worried about being able to support a child and not having enough money, he secretly agrees to join an old pal in robbing the mill owner. Well, he's inept. The robbery fails. He stabs himself, and Julie arrives in time to tell him how much she loves him, and he dies. It's not all over. It doesn't end there. He gets a day off from heaven to make amends. And guess what he does on that day? He slaps his daughter for not believing in him. But she describes it as, the slap that is, as miraculously transformed to a kiss, which Julie understands, and eventually he manages to tell Julie he really loved her. Redemption, and all is forgiven because of the songs. If I loved you, da 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 dum, you know that one, and of course, you'll never walk alone. When you walk through a storm with your head up high. Exactly. It's an English football anthem now, and guess which club? Liverpool, home city of our dearly departed Barbara Willow. Those of you who knew her might be surprised that, Buddhist and feminist as she was, the Book of Ruth in the Old Testament was very dear to her heart. Of course, the true context of the quote from Ruth puts the love expressed in the female solidarity camp, not in the helpmate for men basket. Do we need to know the true context of quotes and stories? Well, in the case of Carousel, it's probably better if we don't. But generally, I think we do. But we don't have to stay there. We can move on from insistence on accuracy. Now, I would like to finish today's address with a tribute to John Shelby Spong, an Episcopalian bishop who died last Sunday, aged 90. And his life's journey shows the value of insistence on accuracy, of knowing about the context, of picking up on details. But it also shows the benefits of moving on from this sort of study, moving on to a new understanding. He was raised with fundamentalist Christian values in the Jim Crow era in North Carolina. As a young man, he was taught that gay people were sinful, women were subordinate to men, and African Americans were inferior to whites. He should always say sir and ma'am to his elders, his father told him, so long as they weren't black. Now, age 12, when he had no idea Paul and Luke had never met Jesus and were relying on hearsay, he was given a Bible. You can imagine it, can't you? Leather-bound, paper, thin tissue paper, loads and loads of maps in the back. Now, he was a bright boy, and unlike most recipients of this gift, he actually read it, noting all the contradictions and discrepancies, and his early books detail these and conclude that it is impossible to take these texts to be literally true. He said the greatest influence on his upbringing was his mother. Now, she belonged to a strict Presbyterian sect that refused to play hymns. Why? Hymns are not God's word. He later targeted that kind of biblical literalism in his books and sermons, telling the New York Times in 1996 that he sought to find a way that people who are despairing of fundamentalism can have a home in this church. Bishop Spong was an outspoken leader noted for his efforts to open the faith to marginalised groups and for preaching a message of love and justice that would resonate in an increasingly secular age. He acquired an international profile while writing more than 24 books. He appeared on Oprah, on the Larry King Show. He served as a bishop from 1979 to 2000, so that's 21 years, isn't it? He infuriated Christian leaders by questioning virgin birth, resurrection of Jesus, and miracles. He was part of a long tradition of theologians who argued that taking the Bible literally was to miss the truth behind its teaching, and he was branded a heretic by his opponents. What he truly came to understand is doctrine. Dogma doesn't make us Christian, said Reverend Canon Kelly Brown. In so many ways, she said, he was ahead of the church. Well, when the civil rights movement took hold, he preached to black and white congregations alike, working to shed what he described as the residual racism of his upbringing. I happen to believe that God's image is in every human being, and every human being must be treated with ultimate respect. See the echo with our first principle. And the black people in America were the first who made this very clear to me, he said. And he said this in a 2001 interview with the ABC, that's Australia's national broadcast. And you can't see on that, but that photograph was actually taken of him when he was visiting Pitt Street Church in Sydney. Spong later expanded his ministry to encompass the fights for gender equality and LGBTQ rights. In 1989, he ordained the first openly gay man into the Episcopalian priesthood, the Reverend Robert Williams. Now, the Reverend Ellen Barrett had been ordained into the priesthood more than a decade earlier, but the Williams ordination made national headlines. Spong had sent letters to all the church's bishops inviting them to attend, thus thrusting the issue of openly gay clergy members to the fore, threatening to divide the denomination. The church's House of Bishops voted to censure him in 1990, but over the next two decades, of course, the tide turned in favour of LGBTQ rights. An Episcopal church court ruled in 1996 that there wasn't any core doctrine barring the ordination of gay men and lesbians. Of course, by 1996, there were buckets of Unitarian ones. So we were sort of ahead of the game there. In 2003, the Reverend Gene Robinson was consecrated as the church's first openly gay bishop. The church voted in 2015 to allow religious weddings for same-sex couples. Bishop Spong was a prophet, Robinson said in a phone interview, using the term in the sense of someone who speaks truth to power, who says those things that people don't want to hear because it calls their morality and their lives into question. I stand on his shoulders, he added. Were it not for the work that he did and the ministry that he did and the advocacy on behalf of LGBTQ people that he did, I wouldn't be a bishop. And he did it long before it was popular or politically correct. He did it because he believed it was the gospel. Now, of course, he was accused at times of being a self-promoter, more interested in making news than ministering to his flock. But he embraced his role as firebrand of his faith, telling the Bergen Record in 1987, the Episcopal Church has always had somebody who raised the questions and forced the church's agenda. There's no question, I am that person now. After retiring as bishop in 2000, he maintained a steady stream of public appearances, delivering more than 175 speeches a year. This is the interesting bit. The older I get, he said, the more deeply I believe, but the fewer beliefs I have. And I think that's probably where I am. I have a sort of mystical awareness that's indescribable. I can't avoid it. When I'm asked to define God, I'm almost wordless. Now, we have quite a few books of Bishop Spong in our library. His beliefs are very compatible with contemporary Unitarian thinking and practice, and I do commend them to you. He was a family man, and he leaves behind five children, a wife, and half a dozen grandees. With all the bad news coming from America about wacky beliefs and corrupt clergy, it is timely to remind ourselves that this man was much revered for his clear thinking and his moral compass. But There is one thing I thought you might want to consider. In Christianity, a lot of hard work has been done to demystify sacred texts and extract the pearls of wisdom. But what about the quotes from the Dalai Lama or from Rumi? Hindu teachings, teachings from North American indigenous people. All of these things are on all sorts of merchandise. As liberal thinkers, we're likely to come across them. Do we know the contexts? And are we sometimes getting the wrong end of the stick about karma, reincarnation, meditation, and so on? Maybe, and this is the thought I'll leave you with, maybe we should accord all traditions that we reference similar respect and put some real work in to extract the real work of the teachings. And we come now to the benediction. You may like to stand if you're able. Let us live in such a way that when we die, our love will survive and continue to grow.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.